toy at the pulpit now in the main service auditorium that I'm going to try playing with a little bit today. We have finally, hopefully, once and for all, got some of our tech adjusted so that I can do some of the things that I've been wanting to do without there being lags, delays, or having to ask the people in the booth. There's a new panel. I should just be able to hit a button and switch up and then switch back just by hitting a button right on the pulpit. So we're going to take that for a spin early, later this morning. So, lesson 227, again, triumph, the final acclamation of the AV. Getting right into the introduction. Since lesson 222, we have been studying the following three topics related to the AV of 1611. Number one, in lesson 222, we talked about its early reception. Lesson 223, we talked about early criticism, most notably Hugh Broughton. And then we talked about early sales in lessons 224 to 226. Under the topic of early sales, we covered the following points in our attempt to understand the early 17th century English Bible market. In 224, we talked about printing capacity of the king's printer, Bible production before the AV, and financing and printing rights. In lesson 225, we talked about a variety of formats and the market structure being a monopoly. And then last Sunday in lesson 226, we talked about ecclesiastical and private sales. All right. So, over the course of these lessons, so that would be all the ones that I've mentioned there, okay? Over the course of these lessons, we have surveyed the scholarly articles by John Bernard, 2005, Graham Rees and Maria Wakely, 2009, Mordecai I. Feingold, 2018, and Kenneth Fincham, 2020, that challenged the long-held view that the AV was not well received by the English-speaking world of the 17th century until the 1630s or later. Early 17th century sermons, in addition to early sales data, suggest the AV was embraced and utilized in public pulpits, both Anglican and Puritan, as well as private homes during the first decade of its existence between 1611 and 1621. That said, prudence dictates that we spend some time surveying the prevailing orthodoxy on this topic because it is not wholly incorrect, especially when it comes to the fortunes of the English Bible, given the vicissitudes of mid-17th century English politics. So, I don't want to leave you with the false impression that the sort of traditional view is wholly wrong. It's not wholly wrong, neither is it wholly incorrect. Okay, so we should still spend a little bit of time looking at it, all right? Especially when it comes to how the English Bible kind of got batted around during a time of political upheaval in England at the time, all right? So, written in 2001, before the groundbreaking essay/journal articles mentioned above, Alistair McGrath's book, In the Beginning, The Story of the King James Bible and How It Changed a Nation, a Language, and a Culture, presented the standard understanding of the ultimate triumph of the AV over the Geneva Bible as the most popular English Bible. Now, Alistair McGrath's book is still a good book. All right, I highly recommend it. It's written in 2001 before the essays that I've mentioned. It's still a good book, and it still has a lot of interesting and good information in it. Okay? In fact, chapter 12 of McGrath's book is titled Triumph, The Final Acclamation of the King James Bible. While I view some of McGrath's details as a bit dated, his overall treatment is still a valid, popular summary and worthy of our time and consideration. Now let me just say this. I have chosen to follow McGrath because he lays it all out and puts it, like, you know, straight over the plate at a speed everybody can get. We could have looked at a whole bunch of other stuff and cobbled together the same information from sort of more scholarly sources, if you will. McGrath's is a little bit more of a popular treatment, but that's fine for what we need it for, okay? So consequently, we will use McGrath's chapter to frame our discussion. So we're going to follow McGrath's chapter here as we work our way through this. So all told, we will cover the following points in the next couple of lessons. We're going to look at the Battle of the Bibles, Charles I and the War Against the Geneva Bible. Second, we're going to look at ambivalence, the period of the Puritan Commonwealth. And last, we're going to look at the Restoration and the final acceptance of the King James Bible. Okay? So, as we get started here on page 2, our main point again is triumph, the final acclamation of the AV. So, McGrath begins chapter 12 with the following paragraph, quote, "By 1850, the King James translation had triumphed." Now, it triumphed way before that, but he's just saying by 1850, he's using that as a date, because he's going to make some specific points, okay? "What was once a curiosity had become a classic. The 19th century showered praise on the King James Bible, viewing it as one of the high points of English literary achievements and perhaps the greatest contribution to the spiritual ennobling of the human race." Now, I don't know that word. Is that the word you were talking about?
No.
Ennobling? So it's ennobling, it's lifting the human race, I guess is the idea there. Such judgments are inevitably projected onto earlier generations. So let's just stop there. By the time you get to the mid-19th century, the King James Bible is widely acclaimed as the greatest literary achievement of the English language. Okay? What he's saying is that we should not therefore read that back on earlier centuries that they also viewed it that way. So in other words, does it take some time for the King James Bible to reach a level of acceptance and perception that it's the greatest piece of literary achievement in English history? That does not happen overnight. That perception and that understanding, it takes some time to build in the English speaking world that the King James Bible had reached this sort of status. Okay? Is that how you understand that, Mike?
Yeah.
Okay? "Given the impressions that the genius and brilliance of the translation were universally recognized from the outset." That wasn't necessarily true. "It is thus tempting to believe that the new translation was rapturously received on publication, being acclaimed immediately as a lasting monument of English literature as much as a superb translation of the Word of God." So it takes time for that to build. Okay? Now, Dr. David Norton, whose work we've looked at in other places, I mentioned him at the end of the lesson for next week. He's written a book called The History of the English Bible as Literature. It's like 470 pages long, and he goes through the history of the King James and how it was viewed as a piece of English literature, and he shows how it changed over time and eventually developed the perception that it is the sort of pinnacle of English, okay? But that didn't happen overnight. So what McGrath is doing is he's explaining this at a sort of popular level, things that there's a bunch of details that you could look at if you wanted to, all right? Now, I'll be honest with you. I read all of Norton's book, the 470-page book, The History of the English Bible as Literature, and I find it fascinating. I think it's probably too much, though. The level of depth there is probably more than what we need to go in this class. But I am trying to decide what pieces of that I think are significant enough to just mention, but understand what McGrath is saying here, okay? The next couple of paragraphs underscore the dated nature of McGrath's analysis in my estimation. So this is where we're going to see a little bit of dated information, all right? Yet history gives us no warrant for such extravagant opinions. Indeed, the evidence at our disposal, that's an important caveat that he makes in 2001, suggests that many saw the final appearance of the new translation as something of an anticlimax. Okay, in other words, it's sort of, it's published and they're like, okay. Like there wasn't any sort of excitement about it, okay? There were those who would indeed speak of the King James Bible in the highest possible terms, but such a judgment lay over a century away. So he's saying that it's not till the 1700s that people start to speak of the King James in very sort of highfalutin, rosy terms, okay? The irrefutable evidence is that, far from rushing out to buy or make use of the new translation, people preferred to use an English translation from 50 years earlier, the Geneva Bible. Now, we've shown from more recent work that that's not necessarily wholly accurate. It's not wholly inaccurate, but it's not wholly accurate either. It's sort of, the truth is in the middle of that scenario. Okay, that's what I've been trying to show you over the last number of weeks. The simple truth is that the, quote, New Bible was initially regarded with polite disinterest. Now, that's a nice way to say it. Disinterest is not the same thing as disdain. Right? Disinterest is, whatever. Disdain would be, we don't like it. Right? There's a difference between disinterest and disdain. Okay? Nobody at the time really liked the New Translation very much. And again, I would say that's not necessarily true, as we've looked at. Even some of those who were prominently involved in the translation of the King James Bible seemed hesitant to use it, preferring to cite the Geneva Bible instead, hardly a commendation for their work. Now look at my added bracket here. Recall from lesson 222 that this conclusion was reached by only looking at sermon epigraphs affixed to sermons and not the full text of those sermons. Remember we talked about that, right? That conclusion was based by looking at the summary epigraphs of these sermons by the King James translators and not necessarily at the full text of those sermons. The King James Bible might be the Bible of the English religious and political establishment. It had a long way to go before it became the Bible of the English people. This chapter aims to tell the story of how an ugly duckling became a swan, how a translation that at first singularly failed to excite the popular imagination went on to be acclaimed as, quote, the noblest monument of English prose, to use a phrase of Robert Loth, 1710 to 1787, sometime professor of poetry at Oxford University. It is a long and fascinating story which can here only be told in part. So let's just stop. Let's look at the next. I kind of follow up with this. Look at the next point. Okay, these statements from the Pen of McGrath highlight how important the essay surveyed in lessons 222 through 226 are to developing a complete picture of how the AV was initially received. Sermons from the period between 1611 to 1630, as well as sales figures, indicate a more robust interest in the King James, in the AV, than historians have heretofore realized. That said, it is true that it took some time for the AV to displace the Geneva Bible, as the popular choice of the English-speaking world. Moreover, recall that continued use of the Geneva Bible was more related to its marginal notes than to the perceived poor quality of the authorized version as a translation. See lesson 222 for more information. All right. So, let me finish this introductory point and then we'll take any questions. For good or bad, it is important to realize the fortunes of the English Bible were influenced by political factors, particularly during the period of the English Civil War. Quote from McGrath, yet such calls for early revision of the AV were not taken with any great seriousness until the 1640s, when the issue had become polarized for political reasons. As parliamentarians who argued for the authority of the English Parliament over the English monarch gained influence around this time, the question of who should authorize a new translation of the Bible became a serious political issue. For many, it was Parliament that should commission a new authorized version, and that authority would derive from the English people, not the English monarch. As parliamentarians were generally Puritan in their religious outlook, it was not a surprise that the Geneva Bible should be suggested as a candidate for such authorization. It is therefore no cause for surprise to learn that the opponents of Puritanism during the reign of Charles I did all they could to eliminate the influence of this Bible with its marginal notes. Okay? So does anybody have any questions or comments before we get into the next sub-point? Yeah.
So, McGrath said by 1850 the King James translation had triumphed. You know, this might sound silly, but triumphed over all other English versions, or?
Well, for sure that, and I think he'd be for sure it had triumphed over other previous English versions, and it had reached a point of renown that it was viewed as not only the best English Bible, but also a piece of, you know, literary excellence, surpassing even William Shakespeare.
Okay.
So the triumph there is twofold in that sense, I think. Now, does everybody see how you got to take McGrath along with the other essays that we covered. If you just went with McGrath, you would get the opinion or the perception or the understanding that the King James Bible was essentially a dud and nobody paid any attention to it till about 60 years later. That's not entirely correct, and research that had been conducted after McGrath wrote this book in 2001 shows you that, okay? But McGrath is also not wholly wrong in the tug of war that occurred in England at the time between the Geneva Bible and the King James Bible. So before we start the next point on page 3, were there any other questions? Were you good with all that, Mike?
Yeah.
Okay. So, did you have another question?
I'm just curious, if the Geneva Bible did not have those marginal notes, would it be such a pushback?
I would say probably not. Arguably no. We can't know for sure because it did, and they were very well received. It might have changed some things, but I still think you would have had your hardcore Puritans who would have been like, no, we don't want a Bible authorized by a king. We want a Bible approved by Parliament. So it probably would have changed it a little bit, but I still think you would have had your sort of hardcore parliamentarians and Puritans who would have still thought that.
I think there are people today who reject the King James on the fact that those marginal notes were taken from the Geneva.
You might be right. I don't really know of too many people. Do you know of anyone who's making that argument? Sounds like you do. Is this just a personal acquaintance or somebody who's written some material on it?
Yeah,
oh, yes, well, you can find all manner of nuts and fruits on Facebook. But I don't mean to be rude, but like, you can find anybody arguing for anything, right? I don't know of too many people who look at the King James today and reject it because it doesn't have the Geneva marginal notes. You might find a few, but they're not going to be very many of them. In fact, most people would reject the King James today because it's too hard to understand, or it's based on inferior manuscripts, or archaic words, or false friends, or something like that. Yeah, or they'll say that the practice of text criticism has evolved beyond the King James, and so therefore the King James is antiquated based on, you know, the oldest and best manuscripts that we now have that the King James translators didn't have. Those are the kinds of things I typically hear people in our day using as arguments for why they don't use the King James. Not because they don't have the Geneva notes in there. And if you did, if that was your argument and you had, say, $1,500, you could go to the auction house and bid on one. Get one if you really wanted one. Anyway, any other questions or comments before we move on? Yeah.
I still think price had a lot to do with the slowness of catching on. Because, you know, 37 shillings back then. I mean, maybe a church could afford a new Bible.
So you're talking about the folio size at a price.
Right.
Yeah.
But even less than that, you know, it was, it's hard to get a grip on the wages of the day, but I read one place where it said a common laborer only made 15 pounds a year.
Yeah, how many shillings are there in a pound? Do you know?
20.
So if they were going to even buy a personal size Bible, let's say 14 shillings, still a lot of money.
A month's wages for a new Bible when you already had one?
Yeah, I mean, for sure economics was a big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. My point is just to say, you got to take what McGrath says and add to it the more recent research to get the more full picture. And that's sort of my main overall point with this. So, the Battle of the Bibles, Charles I and the War Against the Geneva Bible. Okay. As we learn in Lesson 225, 1616 was the last year the King's printer, Robert Barker, published the Geneva Bible. McGrath addresses how the politics of the day impacted the English Bible in the next subsection of chapter 12 titled, The Battle of the Bibles, Charles I and the War Against the Geneva Bible. Quote, As a result of pressure from the authorities, after 1616, the printing of the Geneva Bible ceased in England. The work now had to be imported from the Netherlands. This, however, did nothing to stem its sales. James I seems to have been relatively unconcerned over this matter and did not consider the suppression of the importance of its rival to his own translation due to it be a matter of pressing importance. He cordially disliked the Geneva Bible, but believed that his own new translation would eventually displace it without any need for special action on his part. So what McGrath is saying there is, James, there's no evidence that James ever, by royal sanctioned decree, banned the importation of Geneva Bibles or did anything to really suppress that market through his own activity or intervention in that market. But it is a fact that the King's printer did not print any more Geneva Bibles after 1616. So if somebody wanted one, they would have to import. They'd have to buy an imported one from Amsterdam, okay, which was the press that was still printing them. When James I died in 1625, he was succeeded by his son Charles I. Alistair McGrath chronicles how Charles differed from his father and the impact it had on the English Bible. Quote, however, the death of James I and the ascension of his son Charles I in 1625 saw a change in the religious climate within England. Charles's marriage to the French princess Henrietta Maria had caused considerable popular resentment, partly on account of her being a foreigner and partly because she was a Roman Catholic. So that's a no-no politically, okay? Radical Protestants were alarmed at the prospect of a monarch who would be openly sympathetic to the Roman Church, Roman Church causes throughout Europe. So that's sort of like when JFK as a Catholic was running for president in 1960. You are aware of the fact that there were a lot of people who were not okay with that. Charles, they were worried that he would like move America somehow under the papacy, which obviously never happened, at least not officially. Charles appointed a high churchman, William Laud, as Archbishop of Canterbury in 1633. Archbishop Laud was clearly troubled by the continuing popularity and correspondingly high sales of the Geneva Bible. Under Charles I, religious tensions had worsened with overt opposition between Puritans and Anglicans emerging at point after point. England was divided into the factions that would shortly take opposing sides in the Civil War, pitting Puritan against Anglican, Parliament against Royalist. The Geneva Bible, with its notes, was seen as the Bible of the Puritans, and the King James, the Bible of the Establishment. Okay? So now is the English Bible going to be impacted by the vicissitudes of English politics here? Okay? So the Royalists are going to look at the King James Bible and say, that's our Bible. The Puritan parliamentarians are going to look at the Geneva Bible and they're going to say, that's our Bible. Okay? Essentially is what's going on. For Law, the continuing circulation of the Geneva Bible was therefore a significant contributing cause to the religious tensions of his day, which threatened to tear England apart. Yet it was not the Geneva translation as such that caused Laud and his supporters such heartaches. The real problem lay with the extensive marginal notes, which offered guidance to the reader as to how the text should be interpreted and applied. Although the Geneva Bible dated from two generations earlier, its critique of the abuse of monarchical powers might have been written with Charles I's reign in mind. We have already noted some of the comments which caused such offense to James I and thus were partly responsible for his desire for a new English translation. So we went over this, right? Remember at Hampton Court, James says that he hadn't seen the Bible yet well translated into English, and he said the Geneva Bible is the worst because of the marginal notes that he found to be seditious. We've talked about that numerous times, right? Well, now his son is in charge, and those notes are still festering wound, if you will, to these royalists who believe they're ruling by divine right, and the notes in the Geneva Bible are questioning the authority of the king, okay? James's son, Charles I, felt similarly threatened by the Geneva challenge to the doctrine of divine right of kings. Charles had absorbed much of his father's belief in this doctrine and saw it as essential to the religious and political well-being of his kingdom. William Laud, Archbishop of Canterbury, had a strong personal vested interest in maintaining both the monarchy and the established Church of England, and rightly saw the doctrine of the Geneva Bible's marginal notes as a serious threat to the situation. It was thus natural for Laud to want to minimize the influence of the Geneva Bible at this point. But what could he do? One option might have been to mount a major theological critique of the Geneva Bible by publishing immense numbers of learned treatises countering its criticisms of the divine right doctrine of divine right of kings. But this would take time and have little impact at the popular level. Laud was aware that there was a much simpler solution. All that was needed was an order banning the Geneva Bible from England. But what reason could he give? In the end, Laud hit on an ingenious solution. To support the Geneva Bible, he argued, was unpatriotic. So this is the argument that emerges. If you're going to read that Geneva Bible, you're not being patriotic to the crown. Okay? That's essentially the argument that he settles on. Understand, if he bans it, is he going to have an uprising? Probably. If he bans importation of the Geneva Bible, is he probably going to have a prominent moi? If he just writes a learned treatise debunking the notes, well, that might reach a handful of eggheads in universities, but is that going to reach the common guy on the street? Probably not. So the solution is, well, we'll say it's unpatriotic to read the Geneva Bible. Okay? So, Laud suggested, next paragraph, let me catch up here.
Just one quick note. Whenever you ban something, whenever you say somebody can't have something, that just makes more desirable.
Oh yeah, and that's the basic, you know, that's the basic principle of the law, right? If I put a sign on the wall that says wet paint, what do you want to do? Touch it and see if it's wet, right? There's always that grumpy guy in the neighborhood that puts a sign out that says don't walk on the grass. What does that make every kid in the neighborhood want to do? Walk on his grass, right? That's just the way people are, right? So Laud did seem to have some sense in that regard, that he knows if he bans it, he's just going to foster interest in people. Well, why is he banning it? What's so bad in it that it has to be banned? Yeah.
So it's kind of the equivalent of today saying, oh, that's racist. You're canceling out the whole foundation of it.
Yeah, I mean it's a dismissive tactic to just sort of get somebody to not really evaluate what the argument is. And he's kind of doing that by just saying you're not a real patriotic Englishman if you read the Geneva. Just saying. Okay? So Law suggested that the Geneva Bible posed a threat to the livelihood. Now here's the argument. To the livelihood of the patriotic English printers, whose livelihoods were being threatened by the importation of cheap and well-produced Geneva Bibles. So now he adds to it an economic argument. Okay? You don't want to put these English printers out of business, do you? The commercial success of the Geneva Bible seemed to Law to offer an entirely reasonable excuse to suppress it. As the work was printed abroad, Laud argued would not permitting its continued importation threaten the printing industry as a whole. The Geneva Bibles printed in Amsterdam were better in every respect to the early printings of the King James Bible. If market forces alone were allowed to dictate the outcome of this economic battle of the Bibles, the Geneva Bible would dominate the English market. It may be added that the costliness of the Geneva Bible was the direct result of Robert Barker's monopoly on the text, which allowed him to profit extensively from the work. Now, here's my bracket. Note the tension between these statements from the pen of McGrath in 2001 and the later, more recent research we considered in Lessons 222 through 226. Laud, however, passed over this awkward point and summed up his objections to the Geneva text as follows. This is quoting Law. By the numerous
coving
architectural
term. It has nothing to
so
do.
So let me look that up. I'll have to check the. That might be a typo. Probably is. It should, I think, say by the numerous coming over.
Covering over.
Well, he's talking about these Geneva Bibles coming from Amsterdam.
Yeah.
So I think coming over is probably the right thing, but I'll check it. That's the way I'm going to read it for now.
Okay.
By the numerous coming over of the Geneva Bible from Amsterdam, there was a great and just fear conceived that by little and little printing would be quite carried out of the kingdom. For the books which came from thence were better print, better bound, better paper, and for all the charges of bringing, that would be like taxes, I'm assuming, costs, shipping costs that are going to add to the expense, right? And for all the charges of bringing, sold better cheap. So this is his words, not mine. And would any man buy a worse Bible dearer than they might have a better, more cheap? So in other words, they got better paper, better bindings, okay? Even if you add to it the cost of shipping it, you could still get one of these cheaper than you could get a King James Bible, according to Laud. Okay? So, McGrath's not wholly wrong. Cost is a big deal. And you know how people are, right? Even yourself. If you can get a better made something at a cheaper price, are you going to do it? Okay? Laud thus has a simple economic and patriotic reason for wishing to block the importation of Geneva Bibles. Although Laud was careful to present his reason for wishing to limit the and even terminate the circulation of these Bibles in England as fundamentally patriotic and economic in motivation, many realized that this was merely a convenient excuse for suppressing a work that he disliked for religious reasons. So, people who know what's going on, do they see through this? What Laud's doing? Okay? The Geneva Bible had its origins with Calvinistic circles and was seen as being overtly supportive of a Puritan agenda. A simple answer to Laud's concerns about the future of the English printing industry lay at hand. Permit production of the Geneva Bible in England. But this option does not appear to have been given any serious consideration. So he's not going to do it. Okay? So, Laud's action proved highly effective. The flow of the subversive text into England was staunched. I take that as a belched or, you know, suppressed or, you know, I don't know if it totally stopped, but it certainly was slowed down, I guess. The final known edition of the Geneva Bible was published in 1644. As a result, the King James Bible enjoyed a new commercial success. The word popularity is not yet apposite. Apposite? Apposite, apposite, I'm not sure. It's a word that means appropriate. Now, these British guys, I wish they would just speak proper English.
So you're saying we need a new interpretation of the interpretation?
I wish they'd speak proper American, okay? I'm just kidding, sort of. However, it was not long before a compromise was developed. Now, that allowed the Geneva Notes a new lease on life in England. The popularity of the Geneva Bible, and here he says it outright, rested not so much on the translation itself as on the explanatory material appended to the translation. So, Amy, that goes to your question. The whole time, one of the biggest reasons why the Geneva remained popular was the people liked the marginal notes. Okay? Mike brings up another consideration, and that's price. Okay? But the notes were the biggest deal, in my opinion. They were the political hot potato. They were what the Puritans really liked. The Puritans are not really... There's no evidence that I've seen that they thought the King James Bible was a bad translation in terms of how it rendered Hebrew and Greek words in English. What they wanted were the marginal notes. Okay? So why, some reason, should not the Geneva translation be replaced with the King James Bible while retaining the Geneva notes? Between 1642 and 1715, at least 9 editions, 8 of which originated in Amsterdam, are known of the King James Bible with the Geneva notes. So they eventually take the King James text and add to the King James text the Geneva Marginal Notes.
Was that permitted? I mean,
well, it's being done in Amsterdam, so the King's printers aren't doing it.
Right.
And then it's sold in England. It's imported. Next week, I'm going to show you a title page of one of these. It's very interesting to look at the way they worded this. Okay, but I didn't have space in it in this lesson. Okay. But these pesky Puritans, look at these guys here, look at the next paragraph. But many Puritans regarded this as an unsatisfactory compromise and pressed the replacement of the King James Bible. So they're like, oh, you're selling out, man. We don't want this King James Bible with these Geneva notes. We want us a good old Geneva Bible. And they view this as a political compromise. Okay? So with the outbreak of the English Civil War in 1624, an opportunity to challenge the authority of the King James Bible arose. So, you would think that as Puritans gained control of Parliament, they would then move to do what to the King James Bible? Suppress it. Okay? So before we move on to the next point, does anybody have any questions?
I just have one question. Who are the Puritans today?
Huh?
Who would be the Puritans today?
I don't think there's anybody.
So is that an extinct thing right now?
Well, I mean, it depends how you want to look at it. Okay? You can make an argument that Reformed Presbyterians are in many cases Puritan. Puritanical in their... And it depends on how you want to use the word Puritan. If you use the word Puritanical to refer to, like, conservative dress, denial of wedding rings, if you're looking at Puritanical in that sense, then Mennonite, Amish,
yeah,
you know, some very conservative Baptist groups, possibly Quaker, you might say those are Puritanical. But even in that usage, you have to understand that they're not Puritanical in the true sense of being a Puritan of the English period of the Civil War. I don't think there's any group that fits all of the concerns that the English Puritans would have had at that point today. I think you could point to certain groups that have aspects of, you know, Puritan concerns still, be it doctrinal. So you have to divide that between doctrinal and sort of practical things. So I think that if you look at the landscape of modern Christendom, you'd have a variety of people who were maybe Puritanical in their theology, but not necessarily practice. It's an interesting question, but
I think the Mennonite are, well, they're real strict compared actually to the Amish.
No, Amish are the strictest.
You think they're the strictest?
Oh, for sure.
Are they?
Yes, without a doubt. I can go to the Walmart in Greenville and look at somebody who's dressed in what would appear to be Amish attire. You follow them out into the parking lot and they hop in a van and drive away. Those are not Amish, those are Mennonite. The strictest sense of the Amish are the ones that still do the horse and buggy, no electricity, all that stuff.
But they do hop in a car though.
They'll hop in someone else's car,
right,
but they won't own it and drive away in it.
When I was a kid, there was the Mennonites that were called the Black Bumper Mennonites because they drove cars, but they blacked out any chrome, so anything flashy was not allowed, but they were able to drive cars.
Yeah.
And
the Mennonites or the Amish?
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm talking.
They have a window of trying to spread their oats before they make commitment.
Well, I know that's true of the Amish too. They have a, I don't know, remember the name of it, but there's a period where they leave the home. And they have to decide, they experience the world, so to speak, and then
right,
decide if they're going to remain Amish or not.
Right.
But if they elect to leave the Amish, they're like basically shunned and banned for their whole life.
Yeah.
Okay? But that's where it gets confusing, lines between Amish and Mennonite. There are differences that are significant, you know. But a true Amish is not going to own a car. They might ride in a car that's owned by somebody else, but they don't own a car or drive cars. Mennonites will.
They don't participate
in society either. Yeah, I mean, true Amish view all the rest of us that are not Amish. They call us English. Okay, meaning non-Amish. And then even within the Amish, there's different ordinands, or something is the word they use for it, that have different rules and so
their
on.
Their Bibles are all written in Pennsylvania Dutch.
Yeah.
So we probably would not understand.
When I was, for years, I was invited over Memorial Day weekend to go to a Bible conference in Ohio, and they held the Bible conference in Amish country. And I bought in one of the shops a Dutch, what'd you say it was?
Pennsylvania
Dutch Bible. Just because I wanted to have one.
Right.
So it is interesting. Like, it's a cross. Some of the words you can make out, and some of them are German. It's a weird thing. It's a cross of German and English, and I can't claim to understand it. But anyway, all right. Anything else? All right, next point. So, ambivalence, the period of the Puritan Commonwealth. McGrath explains the fortunes of the English Bible as follows during the period of the Puritan Commonwealth under Oliver Cromwell. In the closing years of the reign of Charles I, the growing political influence of Puritanism began to become of importance to the reception of the King James Bible. The new emphasis upon the authority of Parliament as opposed to that of the King within Puritan circles led to demands for revision of the translation to be undertaken by the state. So once the Puritans get control of the state, do they now want to use the power of the state to order a new translation or a revision of the King James? Okay. Parliament, it was argued, should commission a new translation which would eliminate the errors and ecclesiastical bias of the King James Bible. William Laud had been one of the most formidable opponents of the Geneva Bible and a staunch defender of the King James Bible. However, Laud found himself outmaneuvered by an increasingly confident Puritan Parliament. In 1641, he was imprisoned in the Tower of London, and in 1645, he was executed. Okay, so, you know, his head paid dearly for his support of the King James Bible. With Laud out of the way, serious opposition to the King James Bible gathered momentum. Calls for the revision of the translation became increasingly frequent and strident. In a sermon delivered before the House of Commons assembled at the Church of St. Margaret's Westminster on August 26, 1645, John Lightfoot argued the case for a revised translation, which would be both accurate and lively. Quote, this is quoting from his sermon. In the course of Nehemiah, when he was found reforming, that he caused not the law only to be read and the sense given, but he also caused the people to understand the reading. So he's quoting Nehemiah there. He's referring to the book of Nehemiah. And certainly it would be least advanced... It would not be least advanced, excuse me, that you might do to the three nations, if not the greatest, if they, by your care and means, might come to understand the proper and genuine reading of the Scripture by an exact, vigorous, and lively translation. So in other words, is he criticizing the King James? Okay. The Parliamentary Grand Committee for Religion eventually agreed to order a subcommittee to look into the matter. It was clear that the complaints against the King James Bible could be broadly defined into two categories. The many misprints in the printed version of the text, and that would be printer errors, okay, which caused confusion to readers, and perhaps more seriously, questions concerning the accuracy of the translation itself. A parliamentary group that crystallized around Henry Jesse, noted for his competence in sacred languages, concluded that the literary style of the King James Bible left something to be desired. Quote, many places which are not falsely may yet be better rendered. Similar comments can be found in, I think this should say Robert. Let me check. I think there should be a T at the end of that. Robert Gell's An Essay Towards the Amendment of the Last Translation of the Bible. Yet perhaps one may conjecture that a political issue colored this discussion, in that hostility to the King James Bible reflected a perception that it was hostile to Puritanism, or at least that it lacked the Puritan emphasis that made the Geneva Bible satisfying to its readers. One parliamentary group meeting in 1652-1653 argued that the King James Bible used, quote, proletical language. In other words, the traditional church terminology such as bishop. So they don't like that, because they think bishop is too what? Catholic. And so they don't like the fact that this Bible has bishop in it, because it's using high church language. Okay? This practice, which was specifically laid down in Richard Bancroft's rules for the translators, was very offensive to the Puritans. It reminded them of the religious establishment that they had worked hard to overthrow. There was also new and increased resistance from many Puritans to the inclusion of the Apocrypha in the King James Bible. The Westminster Confession of Faith would reject the inclusion of this group of works in Bibles. Some Puritans wanted immediate action on the matter. Now let me just say, that issue, fairly early on, there's evidence even from the 1620s that there were some issues of the King James Bible that were already omitting the Apocrypha. I recently did a series of 5 videos on the church's YouTube page about the Apocrypha. If you want more information, you can check that out. It might be thought that the period of the Puritan Commonwealth would have seen a new lease on life for the Geneva Bible. In fact, this was not the case. Perhaps there was a realization that the Geneva translation was not as good as might be hoped. In any case, the marginal notes could be had by other means. In the first year of the Commonwealth, an edition of the King James Bible with Geneva notes was published with official backing in London. Now that's a little tidbit that we didn't get before, okay? The Soldier's Pocket Bible, issued in 1643, consisted of selections from the Geneva Bible. The following year saw the final reprinting of the Geneva Bible, which henceforth virtually disappeared from the radar screen of English religious controversy. This is a curious fact, and its explanation remains far from clear. The simplest explanation is economic and relates to the continuation of earlier monopoly regulations under the Commonwealth. Oliver Cromwell conferred the monopoly on the King James Bible to John Field and Henry Hills in 1656, during which year Field became printer at Cambridge University. Field was widely regarded as a monopolist on a grand scale, and it is possible that Field, wishing to gain as much as possible from his monopoly on the King James Bible, sought to discourage the publication of rival versions or the development of revisions. Entirely plausible, though this explanation might be, it must be stressed that we simply do not know with any certainty the true reasons for the waning in popularity of the Geneva Bible at a time which it might have been expected to enjoy a resurgence in popularity.
In 1644, that was the year too that England saw the first English Civil War.
Yeah, that's when it breaks out. So this
that has a big impact on.
So what McGrath is saying is, when the Puritans finally get control, you would think that they would have moved to suppress the King James and elevate the Geneva, but in a major stroke of sort of counterintuitiveness, that didn't happen.
I mean, the societal issues going on too probably played a big influence on that, because now you have Parliament basically arguing over Bibles when there's a war breaking out.
Yeah. So obviously other things are going to take precedent. Okay. So last paragraph on this quote from McGrath: the Commonwealth thus came to an end without the anticipated resurgence in popularity influence of the Geneva Bible. Oliver Cromwell, who was installed as Lord Protector of the English nation in December 1653, failed to ensure Puritan succession. As a result, his death in September 1658, so the numbers are transposed there, 1658 led to the Puritan government falling apart. The resulting political instability eventually led to the restoration of the monarchy in 1660. With Charles II restored to the English throne and a growing public backlash against the excesses of the period of the Puritan Commonwealth, the earlier Puritan opposition to the King James Bible virtually guaranteed that it would be the established translation of the new administration. So when the crown gets control of the reins of government again, people have so had it with the Puritans that any idea of the Puritan Geneva Bible becoming the official Bible is just completely kaput at this point, so to speak. Okay? So, I'm going to go to the conclusion, then we'll see if there's any questions, because I need to get into the auditorium and test out the new toy in the pulpit, okay? Conclusion. In the next lesson, we will consider a couple of important details regarding the editions of the Geneva Bible discussed in this lesson. Furthermore, we will conclude our discussion of the ultimate triumph of the AV by looking at the final period identified above, restoration, the final acceptance of the King James Bible. So the point here is this. Is the English Bible subject to the vicissitudes of English politics? Yes. So even for the most ardent modern King James onlyist, you cannot go back and say in 1611 when the King James Bible rolled off the press that the English speaking world was like, finally, God's word in our language. That did not happen, and that was not an attitude that the people had back then. Okay? The issues that concern them were not even, the issues that concern us were not even known to them at that time. So it is a misuse of history. It's what I've called in other lessons presentism, to take modern day understanding and read it back on people of a past generation. That's not good thinking. Okay?
How did the Puritans gain control?
Well, you know, they raised an army and cut some heads off, and I don't have all the details off the top of my head, but they eventually amassed enough power in an army to overthrow the king.
That sounds so illogical. That, I think it's part of the parliamentary process, though, too. You have the two sides, even to this day. You have the two sides that are completely split. I think they got a little help from.
There's no doubt they might have had some outside political help.
Mercenaries.
Anyway, Mike?
Were Puritans about half of the population then? Or were they?
It's a good question. I don't happen to know offhand what percent they were. But even the parliamentary system today, I read about it or watch stuff, and I'm like, this is still weird to me compared to the way we do things with, you know, with our bicameral legislature and stuff like that. It's just different. Any questions?
Supposedly the pilgrims, they were Puritans that came over in 1612. And, you know, I always remember hearing there was religious persecution. But were they being, you know, what was the real reason they came over?
Well, I mean, there was some element. So they, if you remember, they first leave England and they go to the Netherlands, Amsterdam area, the Netherlands, where these Geneva Bibles are being printed, by the way. And when they get there, they realize that the Netherlands, by the standards of the day, was a very tolerant, open society. Now, that, you shouldn't take from that meant the same thing then that it means now when people talk like that. But they thought it was too permissive. And so that's when then
they were just looking for
they leave the Netherlands to come to the New World. And
pure place where they can basically.
And they come with a charter from the English king for a colony. But if you remember, they're like blown way off course. Like they're supposed to settle somewhere in the Chesapeake area. But you know, around the Jamestown, north or south of there a little bit, I can't remember which. And they end up way off course, way up the northern coast in what becomes Massachusetts. So, you know, if you want to be technical about it, they don't really have a legitimate charter from the king to even establish a colony there. But that's all politics. Like, but they are of that sect that would have been very much did not like the Church of England and would have, you know, been more of this. Now, there's debates about whether the Pilgrims had a King James Bible on the Mayflower or whether they didn't. Okay, the modern version side of the coin, they want to say, oh no, they didn't have a King James Bible on the Mayflower, and the King James only side wants to say there was. I've read stuff on both sides of that issue, and I don't really know which is true. Okay, I don't know. I don't know who's... I think it's pretty documented that there was a Geneva Bible. That seems to me to be pretty clear. Whether the King James only side of that coin has made a convincing case that there was also a King James Bible on the Mayflower, I'm not at all persuaded, and I'm sort of ambivalent to it at this point. I'm open to more information on it, because the case I've read is not very persuasive to me. And of course, so you're going to say, well, what's the case? And I'm going to say, I'm going from memory and I don't remember all of it. So, all right, but we got to quit.